России готовится масштабное реформа силовых
единое
и правоохранительных.
Единое силовое министерство будет создано на основе...
Это новое большое министерство.
КФСБ могут присоединить Федеральную службу охраны и службу внешней.
The sword and the shield of the regime are coming back, or so it seems. The daily newspaper Kommersant reported this week that the Kremlin is about to hatch a plan to establish a powerful new Ministry of State Security that would absorb most of Russia's security services and effectively resurrect the Soviet-era KGB. If the report is true, and nobody's denied it yet, it would mark a sharp departure for Vladimir Putin, who until now has preferred to play divide and rule with Russia's myriad security services and law enforcement agencies. It's the latest signal that Putin's long rule is about to enter a new and potentially sinister phase. Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me here in the studio is co-host Mark Galliotti, a senior research fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, a visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations, and author of the blog In Moscow's Shadows. Welcome, Mark.
Hi there.
And also joining us on the Skype line from Washington, D.C. is Andrei Soldatov, co-founder of the investigative website Agentura RU and co-author of the books Red Web, The Struggle Between Russia's Digital Dictators and New Online Revolutionaries, and The New Nobility, The Restoration of Russia's Security State and the Enduring Legacy of the KGB. Welcome back to the podcast, Andrei.
Hello, thank you.
Thanks for coming on. It's only been a couple of weeks, but there's a lot of material that's up your alley here, so it's appropriate. So the new Ministry of State Security, or MGB, would not only have the same name and acronym as the feared Stalin-era secret police, it would absorb the Federal Security Services, the Foreign Intelligence Service, and much of the Federal Protection Service. It would also be in charge of all politically important criminal cases and, together with the new National Guard, be a key tool of suppressing dissent. So it would effectively be a state within a state. Andrei, you had a good piece in Foreign Policy this week on this. First off, do you think the Kommersant report is accurate? Because it's not been confirmed, but significantly it's not been denied. And if it is accurate, why is Putin doing this now?
Well, unfortunately, I think it might be plausible, and it might happen quite soon, and because it has some logic in it. I mean, a few months ago, actually, it's about maybe 9-8 months ago, Putin started with hectic moves, trying apparently to mobilize his elites and about the government apparatus, and he started selective repressions. And he gave to the FSB a very special role in it. We got the new wave of spy money in the country, and the FSB was made instrumental in conducting these selective reforms. So it was quite anticipated that something would happen not only with all these governors and institutions, but also with the security services, and that Putin had some special in his mind about the security services. And we got actually some confirmation about this plan when we heard the news about the new chief of the Foreign Intelligence Service. And now Mr. Naryshkin replaced Fratkov as a chief, and the rumor in the town that maybe he was put in this position to prepare his service to be absorbed by the FSB.
Yeah, no, the reports came yesterday that Sergei Naryshkin would resign as Duma Speaker and be named head of SVR. And today he was replaced by Vyacheslav Volodin, the Kremlin's chief political fixer and leg breaker. Mark, what are your thoughts? Do you think this is on target? And if so, why now?
Yeah, I mean, I agree that it is almost certainly going to happen in some form or another. I mean, I certainly wouldn't exclude the possibility that what we eventually see is perhaps something slightly less sweeping, or at least that it has a different name. Because again, this is a classic thing. You raise something that looks horrifying, and then when you bring up something that is merely scary, people are actually relieved rather
so just
than
removing the MGB, the Stalin-era
name. Well,
even
that, I mean, just call it National Security or Ministry of Security or something. No. Mm. So, but something is clearly happening. And it's interesting. I mean, the last time that we saw a real push, and it's something that has happened periodically, particularly as the FSB tries to empire build, but the last time we saw this was in 2012, which after all was a point when the country was still in ferment, we were in mid sort of post-Bolotnaya sort of uncertainty, and there were suggestions for the creation of a National Guard and then the creation of a security super agency. At that time, even in the Bolotnaya phase, nonetheless, it was decided not to go for this. It would be too disruptive and not necessarily productive enough. It says, I think, a lot that now we've seen the National Guard created, and now it looks like we're going to see a super agency. And one has to ask, what is it that Putin is fearing more now than he did in 2012? The thing is, 2012, the challenge was from the streets. Now, if any challenge comes, it's from the elite. And so I think that's really what we're seeing.
Well, this is interesting because today in Komsomolska Pravda, I don't know if either of you saw this, but there was an article by Dmitry Olshansky saying it's very, and this again is a very pro-Kremlin paper, and Olshansky, a columnist for Komsomolska Pravda, was arguing that it's great that United Russia got such a big majority, but we really have to be more careful now than ever because historically in Russia, the revolts always come from the top. They always come from within. And we have to be very vigilant about traitors at the top. I thought this was a very, very important signal. Mm-hmm. This was in this morning's Komsomolska Pravda. Now, Mark and Andrei, you both pointed out in pieces you wrote this week. Mark, you had two pieces this week. You've been busy. While the political logic of this is you can see it. It's also there's some dangers for Putin in this. What are the dangers you see, Mark?
Well, I mean, I think for me that there's several. I mean, one is that this is actually an agency which will be strikingly under-controlled. You know, we call this sort of, as a shorthand, as kind of KGB 2.0, but one of the key distinctions between this and the KGB was the KGB was actually kept under a very tight leash by the Communist Party. Right. The Communist Party was well aware what this beast could do, indeed, going back to the Stalin era. And therefore, we had everything from the sort of penetration of party cells to a sort of definite controller. And if one looks at Andropov, who is now almost, as it were, the patron saint of modern Czechists, you know, he was a party guy who was put in to tame, control, and modernize the KGB. So the first point is actually this is an agency which will be under control. And therefore, Putin will be putting a lot of faith, frankly, in the personal loyalty of whoever he puts in charge. Mm-hmm. And that's always a risky thing to do in Russian politics. Second thing that particularly bothers me is that, you know, once again, we see Putin turning to the Czechists as his kind of political Swiss Army knife. You need anything done, when it comes down to it, you rely on the Czechists. I mean, this is clearly, this agency is meant to do everything from deal with corruption generally, when it's obviously not the right kind of corruption, through to controlling the elite, through to controlling the streets and so forth. Now, it's unlikely that it's actually going to be able to do that very well. It's almost much, much more likely that it's going to be consumed in corruption and turf wars, not least because, again, that lack of oversight. And the final difficulty or danger for me is it further narrows the information flows into Putin. There wasn't much scope for plurality of opinion in the briefing process beforehand. Mm-hmm. Now it's going to be even less. So the risk is that Putin gets more and more insulated in a bubble of reports that may well not actually have much bearing on the reality.
Mm. And we were talking off mic, and you think Naryshkin's appointment as the head of the SVR or whatever directorate of this new MGB it'll be, the foreign intelligence arm, will further politicize foreign intelligence because Fradkov, the outgoing SVR head, was pretty much a technocrat, correct? Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's interesting that the SVR has actually become quite marginalized of late. In part, marginalized, I should say, politically. Obviously, it's been as active and as aggressive as ever, but politically it was marginalized, and in part because it didn't jump on the bandwagon of telling the boss everything the boss wanted to hear quickly enough. Now, one could say that was because of the, you know, commitment to the integrity of the intelligence process, or one could just simply say they just weren't as politically savvy as the FSB and military intelligence, the GRU. But one way or the other, they clearly had suffered. That's one of the reasons why they were blamed for what happened, for not sort of predicting what happened in Ukraine, even though it really wasn't their fault. And I think it's highly unlikely that Naryshkin is going to do anything other than dutifully tell Putin what he wants, what he thinks Putin wants to hear. After all, Naryshkin is not a serious foreign policy specialist. He's more interested.
Which doesn't prevent him from having strong views about foreign policy.
Well, absolutely. And in some ways, almost strong views tend to be inversely proportionate to actually how much you really know.
Andrei, do you agree that Putin is afraid of something right now in order to do this, as Mark suggests? And also, what are the dangers in this for Putin in creating such a super agency?
Well, I think it's quite clear he's getting nervous, and he was nervous before the elections, and he's is still extremely nervous about the elections in 2018. But I think maybe the biggest danger is that we are, maybe we do not understand it now, but maybe we are witnessing something much, much bigger, because the very first time it looks like Putin decided to change his concept of his relationship with his security services. And it's a really something big. It's a major shift. Maybe we witnessing the console at the end of the idea of the new nobility. Because the new nobility, as it was, say, proclaimed in the beginning of the 2000s, was the idea very distant from the idea of the Soviet KGB. The people from KGB and FSB were asked by Putin not only to do what security services are supposed to do, to even in the Soviet state, to guard, to protect the political regime, but also they were turned into a recruitment base for filling key positions in power and state-owned corporations and state-controlled corporations. And also they were asked to produce a sort of the new national idea of Russia. So what we see now, it looks like some years ago, Putin got slightly disappointed with the outcome. And if you look at how FSB actually responded to the challenges to the stability and to the political stability in Russia, surprisingly, not the FSB or the organization which provided and came up with solution. If we believe that Kremlin was really afraid of, say, color revolutions, well, it was not for the FSB to propose a solution trying to create all these pro-Kremlin youth movements. And when you got the protests in 2011, 2012, once again, not the FSB, which played actually the primary role in trying to persecute protesters and starting all these criminal cases. So these people were actually not so... They look at really not really effective. And it looks like now Putin decided simultaneously to do two things. He decided to push the FSB into the direction very familiar for the KGB to hunt down foreign spies, because it's such a good thing. You just inspire spy money and you intimidate lots of people, and also to control the elites. But at the same time, he decided to quietly to strip the FSB of some of the functions which were not completely inherent for the KGB. I mean, well, what we see now, the FSB is quite suddenly stopped to be a recruitment base for Putin. Mm-hmm. Now we are talking about technocrats like Vino, we are talking about people from his bodyguard service, but we are not talking about the new appointees from the FSB. And also, if we try to understand, say, who are actually people who pretended to be ideologues of the FSB, people like Yakunin and people like Sergei Ivanov, both of them were fired by Putin. And I think it's a very clear signal that maybe he tried to make the FSB what it once used to be, just a political instrument.
Well, that's very interesting, Andrei, because this is something the FSB has long wanted, in my opinion. They've lobbied for it in the past, and Putin resisted them in the past, and now he's giving them what they've always wanted because they displeased him in the other functions, like recruitment, that Putin gave to them. Do you not see some irony there? I think that's pretty interesting.
Well, the problem is that some of them, they wanted to get this role, but most of them were quite passive, and for a reason, because for many years we were given all these expanding powers and resources, and at the same time they stayed absolutely impenetrable, and the immediate result is that if you have such a security service in such a great position to be given all these powers and to be not really responsible and answerable to anyone, it means that people they get lazy. And that was a big problem before the protests and during the crisis in Ukraine. They got lazy. So Putin tries now quite hard to make them active again. And I think the biggest danger is that lots of people inside of the security services are not really ready for this kind of change. And the other thing is, you cannot just say, look, now we are trying to get the KGB back. Well, 25 years passed, A lot of things happens with all these security services. For example, the FSB developed its own foreign intelligence branch, and I don't think that they would easily get along with the SVR people, and it would be big chaos. And actually, it's the irony I see is that Putin tries to do all these things apparently to mobilize people. But what he can get in result, he might get some chaos in the security services for months or maybe years.
Do you see him potentially, as Mark does, creating the one organization that would have the potential power to turn on him at some point? I mean, is this a danger for Putin?
I don't think so, because in the present, and not really recent Russian history, we didn't see any signs of, say, horizontal networks inside of the security services. It's quite interesting that the Russian army, the military, and the security services were absolutely, well, have been absolutely unable to create any kind of underground organizations. And it was really remarkable. In this case, in this, well, the situation, well, the Russian security services and military, they are very different from, say, the Middle East or Egypt or Turkey.
Mark, I saw you were writing, which means you have something intelligent to say.
Well, I mean, just a few thoughts. Again, it's interesting. I mean, I'm not sure if I mean, again, I think maybe it's just a difference in focus. I don't know if I necessarily see this so much as mobilizing people as actually on a more institutional basis, trying to create new structures to do what he wants. And it's interesting for me that in so many ways, actually, Putin, and I know we'll be talking in the second part about the sort of the wider
political context after the elections, yeah.
But the extent to which, in some ways, he's going back to Soviet instruments. Mm-hmm. Earlier, Putin, we saw this model of, in effect, bureaucratic pluralism, mm-hmm. whereby multiple overlapping agencies would compete, and okay, that created certain inefficiencies, but it also created certain sort of capacities precisely to play them off against each other, and sometimes
mechanisms.
Efficiencies as well, actually, as each wanted to do the job better. Unfortunately, the job also tended to involve embezzlement. now we're going back to a much more of sort of departmentalization, you know, a handful of super agencies under individuals. And again, I think that's a key point, individuals rather than institutions on whom Putin feels he can rely. And in this respect, it's very Soviet. It's all gigantomania. It's the kind of political monogorod. You know, it's very much this monopolistic approach. That said, though, I mean, I think that the question becomes what this agency is meant to do, and how the natural dynamics of the Putin system will distort it. Because that, you know, let's be honest, that's what's going to happen. You know, Putin clearly sees this as something as a way of, you know, mobilizing the security apparatus that he still regards as being, you know, presumably more efficient or more potentially effective than others, to do a variety of things. And everything from helping keep the economy on track to keeping the elites on track to whatever. The problem is actually the extent to which, and I mean, here I would definitely agree with Andrei, the people involved are not necessarily embracing that vision. Mm-hmm. I would imagine that they're much more likely thinking, wow, think of the new opportunities for personal enrichment, for the prosecution of personal vendettas and similar. Because that's has been, as it were, the human level dynamic of Putinism. And again, I think for me, this again speaks to this thoroughgoing disconnect between, as it were, the security apparatus as Putin thinks of them, and the security apparatus as actually exists on the ground.
Mm. Now, we're talking about individuals here, and there's one big question that's on my mind, and I hope it's on both of your minds as well. Whom does Putin trust to run this thing? I raised it on the Daily Vertical yesterday, and I'm at a loss. I mean, when he created the National Guard, which also is another powerful agency mm-hmm. that you want, and certainly in the hands of somebody you absolutely trust. He gave it, of course, to Viktor Zolotov, his longtime uber-loyal bodyguard. And okay, Putin trusts Zolotov. That's understood. There's only one Zolotov, right? Who do you see? I mean, I'm asking to speculate here, but I mean, do you see anybody that Putin trusts? Because it's going to have to be a heavyweight. You're not going to pull a Vino out of the nowhere to run this, I don't think. Or are you, Mark?
That is always the wild card option. I mean, anyway, if one thinks of the obvious names, well, one could just simply say Bortnikov, the current head of the FSB, given that clearly the FSB is going to be the central spine
out of favor.
Of this. is reportedly out of favour, but nonetheless, I mean, that would be, as it were, a low-impact choice. Mm. And, I mean, I don't think out of favour does not mean I don't think that Putin doesn't trust him. It's just that, frankly, he's not one of Putin's closest cronies.
Patrushev?
Well, that was my other thought, that it will be a return. You know, that's certainly possible. I mean, he's got the background and he appears to have Putin's favour. And let's be honest, the Security Council increasingly is just simply a mechanism for communicating plans to the people who need to be. Essentially, you know, actually all you really need is just an email, mail shot,
right,
to do that. You don't actually need to have a heavyweight person in charge of running it as Secretary of the Security Council. So Patrushev would be a possibility. In my most feverish moments, I almost imagine sort of him ringing up Ivanov and saying,
"Now that's the last.
Is the holiday over?
That is the last person I expect."
Well, I expect so too.
I don't think Putin
trusts
him.
But I think the trouble is that we are precisely in this situation. Well, except the only virtue of putting someone in that position is that then they become highly visible.
Mm-hmm.
But the
and
point
highly
is,
powerful, and it's somebody that, let's face it, Putin's afraid of Ivanov stabbing him. He's been afraid of him stabbing him in the back for a long
but
time.
Again, at least in this respect, there are some good old-fashioned Soviet tactics, like you make damn sure you choose this person's first deputies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are mechanisms. Mm-hmm. And I don't think, I mean, I don't think he thinks Ivanov was actually going to try and put something in his tea. I don't think it was that kind of mistrust. It was something rather more general. But again, I think the thing is, what we have seen is this increasing tendency to promote people whom he likes, and I suspect often way beyond their displayed capabilities. Mm. I'm almost beginning to think they're actually also in some ways heading back to a slightly sort of Yeltsin situation when he pulled Grachev out to become Minister of Defence, ludicrously over-promoting the guy. So, you know, it might well be that for all we know, currently, I don't know, there's some deputy head of the Presidential Security Service who is suddenly going to be jumping three rungs.
Well, I'm wondering if it's not going to be another one of his bodyguards. I mean, they seem to be ascendant right now. I don't know which one, but that's certainly a possibility. I think Patrushev is a realistic possibility. I wouldn't bet the farm on Ivanov, although it's intriguing. Andrei, what do you think? I mean, who does Putin trust to run this monster?
I think that logic of the last appointments clearly shows that Putin is desperate to find a new recruitment base and a new generation. And I think, all of these things are, of course, possible that Mark named, but I think maybe now the idea is to try to find new generation. And in this case, Putin is short of options because he needs to choose between people he knows, personally, which means people at the administration of the president and people and his bodyguards. And if you look at, just to make things a bit more complicated, I would say that, look, quite surprisingly, Bortnikov got two powerful deputies just last year, and both of them have surprisingly good connections to the Kremlin. One of them served at the presidential administration, and he was put in charge of our counterintelligence department. And he's seen now as extremely powerful figure, so he might be promoted to be the next director of the FSB or the new security service. And another one was appointed just in December, and he was in charge of economic security in this beautiful city of St. Petersburg, which means that both of them actually might be considered as possible candidates.
Mark, you wanted to jump in here.
I just suddenly occurred there was actually one other name that I hadn't thought of before. Shoigu.
Mm.
You know, if Putin wants someone who is efficient at knitting together multiple agencies, which is what he did so well with the Emergency Situations Ministry, who, you know, seems to be a highly competent individual who doesn't at least express higher ambitions, and who I think would be regarded with a degree of relief by many within the elite rather than terror.
Yeah, because people, he's not made a lot of enemies.
But again,
people
it says
really
something that we honestly, we just pulling names out. As easily be exactly, you know, a sort of a deputy head of the FSB, a favoured bodyguard, or someone from the sort of analytic side of the presidential administration that caught Putin's eye. when he was doing briefings on foreign, on political affairs or whatever. I mean, until Putin gets his clones matured, I mean, I think this is it. You know, he seems to be casting around desperately for finding his new generation.
I think this speculation is worthwhile because I'm waiting for two data points right now. I'm waiting for the official confirmation that this is happening. That's the next data point I'm waiting for. And then after that, it's who's going to head it. And I think we're going to learn quite a bit from those two things. I wanted to spend a little time talking about resistance from the other security agencies. Because I think that I don't think everybody's universally happy about this. Although there's been a surprising lack of this popping up, at least above the surface, above the radar in the Russian press and public discussions. Where does the National Guard fit into this scheme? Where does the Investigative Committee fit into this scheme? I mean, my understanding is it's going to be put basically completely neutered and put back under the prosecutor's office. Mark, what do you think about that? How do the other agencies, and particularly the National Guard and the Investigative Committee, fit into all this?
Well, certainly, according to sort of the obviously carefully curated Kommersant leak, the Investigations Committee precisely is going back under Chaika in the General Prosecutor's Office.
And now, Bystrykin's supposed to be on his way out.
Yeah, let's be perfectly honest. That would be a very, very uncomfortable position for Bystrykin, given that he created the Investigations Committee by basically stabbing Chaika in the back and wrenching the committee out from under there. I imagine Chaika would be delighted to have Bystrykin back.
Yeah.
No doubt, if he has toilets that need unblocking or anything. But, I mean, I think, you know, realistically speaking, Bystrykin will, you know, maybe he'll follow Markin to Roskidro, you know, find some suitable sort of honourable sinecure or something like that. So I think in the Investigations Committee, it's no longer needed if you have this super agency, because clearly this super agency is going to take on the role of being
the politics police.
Precisely. National Guard, I think that is a separate agency. I mean, and this answers one of the questions which has been sort of hanging fire. It's that, again, the natural empire-building logic of Putin's politics would have indicated that the National Guard would have at some point started to say, well, we also need some kind of investigative, you know, intelligence-gathering arm so that we know whose doors to kick down. And we didn't hear that, which, again, is actually moderately surprising.
Because Zolotov's a good boy.
Exactly, and clearly because on some level there had been some thought that, in fact, that aspect of things might well be being covered in the future. That clearly this is not just simply a couple of random developments. This is all part of a process.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the National Guard will remain what it is. And it's interesting that at the same time as the National Guard is going from strength to strength, we've had news that the Interior Ministry complement is being reduced slightly.
Yes.
So clearly, you know, we know where
it's
the
being
real
reduced
power.
And it's going to the National Guard was the official explanation from the Interior.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, so basically we know where the power lies. And again, you know, this clear sort of departmentalization. But one last point, you mentioned the lack of
pushback
that we've seen, at least. Again, and I contrast this interestingly with when there was the attempt to have Dumin, again, you know, Putin favorite ex-bodyguard, made the head of GRU, military intelligence. Mm-hmm. You actually had quite a lot of quiet and not so quiet briefing. There was a lot of it was actually in the media. Here we've had the FSB sort of, or people from the FSB saying that they thought it was a great idea, which of course they would. And strikingly, the SVR and the FSO being terribly quiet.
And I've seen surrogates or people that you would expect to toe the regime's line doing exactly that, saying this is a good idea. I saw there was an interview with one reserve FSB general saying this will make the work of the security services much more efficient. Brilliant idea. Of course, you expect the FSB to say that. Denishenko, the outgoing chair of the Duma Security Committee, saying good idea. This nothing to be scared of here. So there hasn't been much pushback at all.
Which implies it's all circumstantial, but it definitely implies that a decision has been made, because you only push back, frankly, if you think there is some scope, if you think there's a chance. Otherwise, why stick your head over the parapet?
Yeah, no. And when I first saw this, my first reaction was FSB intrigue. They're lobbying for what they've always lobbied for, because they've been lobbying for this forever. And then as the week went on, I was like, this looks like, you know, I'm not seeing any pushback. This looks like this looks serious. Andrei, what do you think in terms of pushback from the other agencies? And then the GRU is another one that we should mention. That's going to be the main competitor of this in terms of intelligence. Andrei, what do you think in terms of pushback from the other agencies? Are we going to see it? And again, the role of the National Guard and the role of the Investigative Committee in all this.
Well, to be honest, I'm not really surprised his lack of pushback, because we saw these things before. I mean, remember when supposedly powerful agency, anti-drug agency, was just destroyed. We got some claims made by mid-level officers about how they treated by the Interior Ministry, but that was all. Viktor Ivanov ostensibly published something on the FSB on his Facebook page, and that was all. And I think it's reflects the reality. The situation that we were dealing with in the 1990s, when we have very powerful, almost feudal institutions fighting each other, almost gone. We have maybe the only security or law enforcement agency which is still enjoys these positions of being powerful, active, and ready to fight for its interest is the Investigative Committee, just because Mr. Bastrykin happens to be the guy who runs the agency and he founded this agency. So he was in position to appoint everybody inside of his committee, and these people are extremely loyal to him. And maybe it's not a big surprise that his fate was decided even before his announcement, and this information was leaked about Markin, about mm-hmm. himself, just to pacify him and just to maybe to warn him not to do anything. And to be honest, it's the only agency capable of resist mm-hmm. of doing anything against this plan. Other agencies, of course, they are not in position to do these things. They are all headed by people who are not really trusted by their subordinates. That's the problem.
I mean, if you look at the affected agencies, you're talking about the SVR, the Foreign Intelligence, which is not in any way in a position to resist this. You're talking about the FSO, which I think my guess would be in favor of this.
By the way.
Pardon?
An FSO are not in position to resist just because we just got a new head and right. Wolf is done. And so it's they're not in position to be, say, united behind their leader, because there is no leader.
And the Interior Ministry, I mean, they seem to be being downgraded, but they don't seem to be resisting at all.
I don't think they really have much scope to do so. I mean, A, because this isn't their responsibilities, technically.
Right.
B, because... Anyway, the Interior Minister has more or less made it clear that he's sticking to being a political technocrat, essentially.
Right, he's a real copper.
Exactly. To be honest, they have suffered so heavily already that, to be honest, if they made more of an inconvenience, I think they probably find they risk even worse things happening to them.
What about the GRU?
The GRU, again, we're back to the Soviet-era model in a way.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
The GRU will do GRU things and will continue to do so. And the military will make it clear, and rightly so, that they have to actually keep it. I mean, it's worth mentioning that this model of a sort of a super agency that spans domestic and external security is not quite, but almost unique in the world. That's not how most countries organize themselves, because it doesn't make sense. I mean, even Azerbaijan has actually just dismembered its security apparatus to create an external and a domestic security separate services. Mm-hmm. I think they clearly need to keep the GRU. There will continue to be overlap. But whereas in the past, anyway, as it were, the GRU did have quite a bit of muscle compared to the SVR, if the SVR is now truly and, shall we say, sympathetically rolled into some new super ministry, then, in a way, I think we might well see the balance of power out in the residenturas shifting back towards the SVR's way a bit.
Uh-huh.
Well,
Andrei, your thoughts on the GRU? What do you think there?
Well, in this area, we have all our disagreements with Mark all the time, because I do not believe in the idea of GRU as extremely powerful or, say, independent agency. I think that all things about GRU is all things about Shoigu, and it's all depends on him. It's about his solutions, his ideas. It's about his relationship with the Kremlin. It's not about the department. The department is not in position to do anything independently. And I think for Shoigu, essentially, this Soviet scheme to have KGB and GRU is really appealing. And he would try to save it by by all costs. It's just about his game and about his mentality and his understanding of how these things should be done. And he loves this Soviet example of two security services.
So you would, the GRU has no reason to push back and no resources to push back on this. So it seems we're not only getting, we got the sword and the shield of the regime in the new MGB, and the National Guard will play the role of the fist of the regime, if you want to push the metaphor. All right. Well, on that note, we'll shift gears and continue our discussion in a few moments and broaden the aperture to look at the larger political context of what seems to be happening with the security services. I would like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me in the studio is co-host Mark Galliotti, a senior research fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, a visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. And joining us on the Skype line from Washington, D.C. is Andrei Soldatov, co-founder of the investigative website Agentura.ru and co-author of the books Red Web, The Struggle Between Russia's Digital Dictators and Online New Revolutionaries, and The New Nobility, The Restoration of Russia's Security State and the Enduring Legacy of the KGB. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You could read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfrl.org. And you could follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
С большим отрывом лидирует Единая Россия.
Единая Россия получает конституционное большинство.
Единая Россия одерживает победу на...
Получила конституционное большинство.
Результат хороший.
On the same day Kommersant ran its story about the return of the KGB, Russians woke up to the news that the ruling United Russia Party controlled 3/4 of the seats in the State Duma. I don't think the timing was an accident. A one-party state and a new KGB. Seems we've seen this movie before. You can call it that Soviet 70s show. Tie these things together for us, Mark. I do think they're related.
Yeah, I think it's a combination of things here. Clearly this is not the Soviet Union, because the Soviet Union still had, as I mentioned before, a communist party and at least a titular ideology. Very few of the people in charge of the system, I think, honestly, sort of believed their Marx and their Lenin, but still, there was something that kind of gave a constriction, a shape. As Andrei has mentioned, there's been this struggle to try and find a Russian idea. There's been thorough deinstitutionalization of the state. So what we're actually getting is, to overuse another little sort of trope of the moment, hybrid 1970s. essentially, we have many of the forms, exactly, that you have a parliament whose role is really just to be a rubber stamp and to be an expression of the solidarity of the peoples behind the regime.
And the appointment of Vyacheslav Volodin, the suggestion by Putin that Vyacheslav Volodin become the speaker of the Duma today was an indication. I mean, there's some logic to that. You need somebody in charge of this Duma that's a good leg breaker, and Volodin certainly is that.
Exactly. So you have a parliament that you will try to control. You actually have, obviously a sort of an omnicompetent omnibus security agency will do everything from try and steal foreign technological secrets and fight corruption all the way through to oppressing dissidents and spying abroad. And you have a cult of leadership, which once upon a time was a cult of the party, more than in individuals, despite the personality cults of particular leaders, that has now been replaced with a cult of the national idea, as expressed by its saint and high priest, Putin.
Right, you have a cult of the personality.
But the thing is, these are all the structures, but as it were, the connective tissue that held it together in however a ramshackle way in the 1970s is absent. It's actually, and now almost you have the sort of state-controlled TV as much as in some ways what has replaced the Communist Party as the mobilizational instrument.
Mm-hmm.
And that really can't work.
Because United Russia is not, for it, as many seats as it won in the Duma, it's not a party like the Communist Party with all the power that it had. It still has to is not the ruling. We call it the ruling party, but it's not really.
It's not a party in any meaningful sense. It has no real ideology beyond.
It's a tool.
We're in favor, and as has been fairly convincingly, I would say, demonstrated. I mean, even given all the admixture of administrative resources and everything else, I mean, this was a very, very heavily rigged election.
Yeah, even more so than 2011, ironically.
Exactly. So, I mean, I think put all that together, and this is a sort of a, a fake simulacrum of a political party.
Andre, your thoughts tying all this together, the political context and what we're seeing with the security services right now?
Well, I think I totally agree with Mark. Like, we are seeing something similar to the 70s, to the late 70s, maybe early 80s. And maybe just because Putin, well, just remember these times, and he tried to imitate the model he saw, and along with all his friends. The problem is, and I think, again, Mark is absolutely right, is if, say, we forget about this model, about the new nobility, about that you have people in charge from the security services, at from the KGB, etc., at least these people, they had some sort of, I don't know, not the idea of ideology, but at least some sort of, I don't know, common worldview, if you say. But with the new generation and with the idea that the all-powerful new security services would be degraded to the role of a political instrument, you have a voice, you have a vacuum. You need to replace this vacuum, because the party was not only about ideology. As the Communist Party was about all these private consultations, what is allowed and what is not. That was the essence of the Soviet system, because you will remember, in the Soviet Union, nobody read, say, Soviet legislation. Nobody cared about the Soviet constitution or the criminal code. You need to go to the party cell to ask what is actually allowed and what you are allowed to do. And at the level of the administration of the president, it works today, and it's I saw it in my job, because, I mean, covering all these issues with the internet, it's quite clear that the administration of the president tried to recreate this model, trying to engage big companies, internet companies and telecommunications companies, media, in this sort of private conversations. The problem is, you have a big country. So how you can replicate these things in every region? You cannot just send 2-3 guys from the presidential administration to be in place if someone wants to be consulted. You need to create some sort of institutions for that. And, well, let's see what might happen with United Russia, and specifically with the Popular Front. Maybe they would try to create a new institution, because they desperately need something to run the country.
Now, another big question that's in my mind right now is, and I alluded to this in the first half a bit, but what is it exactly that Putin is so afraid of right now? Because this seems to be an indication that he is very nervous about something. You've both indicated this. And we're talking about, okay, he's nervous about the 2018 elections. He's clearly not nervous about losing those elections. Given what we just saw in the Duma elections, there's no problem fixing elections. And the lack of protest and the low turnout showed me that the public has pretty much stopped caring. So it's obviously not the public he's afraid of. He's afraid of a palace coup. What is it he's afraid of right now? And is this a stopgap just before we get to 2018 and we'll shift to something new? Or is he trying to create something more enduring right now? What do you think, Mark?
Well, I mean, I'd say that, I mean, yes, this is in some ways political mortality nipping at his heels. He doesn't necessarily, I think, have a specific... If he had a specific scenario, if he thought, this is what I fear, this very specific thing, then I think we would actually see much, much more specific responses rather than this, actually, which is clearly a systemic response. You know, we are seeing a change. Late Putinism is going to be something systemically different, very different from early Putinism. And we're still seeing it form, as it were. We saw the ideas of late Putinism emerge when he sort of came back to the presidency. Now we're actually seeing that take institutional form in some form. So I think, yes, I mean, his concerns, I think, sort of are ones that stretch across over the next 2 years and beyond. And I think they are of a Kremlin that feels assailed not by immediate challenges, but by forces that are clearly turning against it. And this is Putin in his King Canute moment. if you look at the masses, sure, there's no mass protests, but on the other hand,
social protest is on the rise.
There's a rise in atomized social protests that actually, if nothing else, makes governing the country harder, even if they're not currently sort of uniting. But also that massive non-turnout. It's great on one level that they're not actually supporting the opposition, but this is also in part a mobilization regime, and actually therefore this says something about the failures.
Are they moving away from being a mobilization regime and going to being a passive acquiescence regime?
Well, this is it, and
which
I think
was the model in the early, in very
exactly
early Putinism.
This is actually also the 1970s model. Yeah, everyone knew they had to turn out to vote and turn out to do their Subotniks and whatever, but no one believed in it. It was a they pretend to pay us, we pretend to work society. Well, I mean, maybe this will be heading towards the we pretend to vote and they pretend to care society. So, I mean, I think the masses, you know, it's not that he necessarily thinks that there's going to be mobs storming the Kremlin walls, but nonetheless, his old model, which actually rested on an assumption that the Russian people were enthusiastic supporters, I think is going. The elite, whether it's directly through a palace coup or whether it's the indirect thing that he's clearly inveighing against already, the extent to which people are just too busy doing their own deals, stealing what they can from the state treasury, because every ruble that you steal is a ruble that Putin doesn't get to play with and that he can't then use to, for example, shore up his hard power instruments or whatever else. I think it's that sense that everything is sliding away from his hands, and that's why he's trying to create these new institutions which can be his strong right arms to re-grab them.
Do you think he's moving away from the model of using corruption as an instrument of control? Because on one hand, yes, every ruble that's stolen is a ruble he can't play with, but every ruble that's stolen is also a mark in somebody's dossier that he can use to control that person in the future.
I don't think he... I mean, again, I think that's a product of a slightly older, more legalistic model. You know, if he wants to catch people, he can find some grounds, even if they have been absolutely blameless in their lives. I think, I mean, corruption will clearly continue. It is absolutely central to the regime. He couldn't do anything about it. But I think we're back to this model of trying to, as it were, control that corruption. I think at the moment what we're seeing is a dawning realization of the extent to which that is not just, as it were, the corruption that he signs off on. And by all accounts, that is one of the areas in which, you know, this most hands-off of presidents actually is very hands-on when it comes to basically the apportionment of contracts and money. But also the huge extent to which people are doing their own thing. And in some ways, and again, usual health warnings apply whenever one has this parallels with Stalin.
Right.
But nonetheless, I'm almost felt that this is one of the things that actually led Stalin towards when after World War II. Who's clearly gearing up for a new round of purges with the doctor's plot and so forth before he died. And it's not so much that I think he felt that he faced direct and open opposition. It was more that he just suddenly realised the extent to which actually the elite no longer regarded him as a single pivotal figure of the whole system. That, I think, is in a way is the concern for Putin.
Well, this is one of the arguments Nikolai Petrov made in this widely circulated piece in Vietnamisty, where he said that actually we've been talking about Brezhnev in the 70s a lot, but that Putin was actually moving away from a Brezhnevite kind of system and into a more leader-centric Stalin system, again, with all the health warnings that apply when you invoke Stalin. I think it also is worth noting that in 2 weeks, Putin will turn 64. That was the age Leonid Brezhnev was in 1970, as the Soviet Union was about to enter a decade of stagnation and increased political repression. Andrei, what are your thoughts? What is Putin afraid of? Is this a stopgap just to get ready for 2018? Is this something more permanent? What are your thoughts?
I think it's something much more general, because these people are trained by the KGB. They live in the world of threats. And the problem is that many of his threats and many of the events of the quite recent Russian history, they never properly explain it or by the security services. Nobody inside of the FSB tried to explain why we got 1991 and why the KGB was so passive. And it was a direct emotional, it has a direct emotional impact when we got, I mean, Ukraine got Maidan, because actually people saw the same thing. We see the abandoned buildings of FSB for unknown reasons. And of course, it was a very, well, scary, well, picture on TV for Putin and his people, and it's still a big problem. It looks like the crisis might, like, rapidly develop and from almost nowhere, and with some hostile from outside of the country. And for him, it's the biggest problem. But, and also, of course, he understands that, look, we try to compare the situation with the 70s, but what we need to remember is the role of fear in the 70s. Well, it was a post-Stalin society, and everybody, I mean, people in the 40s and 50s, they all remember Stalin. Putin himself, when he described how he joined the KGB, he immediately said that, yes, I remember people who saw it in Stalin security services. So the society remembered very well what might happen and what actually happened with the country. And in this situation, you need sometimes just to send a message of intimidation. That would be enough. And that was extremely, well, I would say, really true about the 70s. As society, we got very few dissidents just because people had very good memory. But now we have a very strange situation. Putin started spread fear in 2011, 2012. But in some areas, especially in my area, I mean, the internet regulation, all this stuff about the internet censorship. Look, how long can you just try to intimidate people doing almost nothing? Mm-hmm. And that's a big problem, because if nothing really awful followed, well, people might get skeptical mm-hmm. about all these threats. And actually, this is what's going on with the internet industry. Putin and his people, they sent this very strong message that they can completely ban Facebook and Google and Twitter. Nothing happened. So you cannot play on these kind of cards for so long. You need to do something. And I don't think that there is a very easy way to get out from the mobilization society and mobilization regime. You need to do something. You can't just pacify people and say, no, now it's everything is fine. You need to do something else. And my concern is might be that he is, maybe he tries to think about what might be the role of selective repressions. Mm-hmm. And might be it's a good point to try to, well, to confirm this climate of intimidation with something more sinister. Because, it's just logical.
No, that's interesting, Andrei, because the place I wanted to go next and the last thing I wanted to talk about before we wrap up is there was a very interesting piece in Sloan.ru this week, which made this historical argument that every time in the history of the Soviet Union and post-Soviet Russia, the reorganization and reconsolidation of the security services always preceded a period of mass repression. And that makes me, when you're saying, you're talking about selective repressions, mass repressions, are we going to see an increase in repression, Mark? What do you think?
I'm not sure. I mean, I absolutely agree with Andrei in terms of the logic that says you can only pretend to be a threat for so long. After a certain point, mm-hmm. you actually have to demonstrate that. Though, again, I think in an age of mass media and therefore in some ways of mass surveillance also, it does become easier. I mean, I think that what we're seeing is still a situation in which actually a lot of people are conscious of the need not to demonstrate anti-government sentiment, whether that's in the office or on the streets or whatever else.
Back to the kitchen table, then.
Yeah, exactly. And again, I don't think it's necessarily because they think they're going to be dragged off to Lefortovo. But I think it's instead because you just know that that might, you know, interfere with your promotion chances mm-hmm. or affect your family or whatever. There are if the 70s teaches us anything, and Andropov's KGB was after all very much about maximum impact with minimum effort. It was the era of the so-called prophylactic chat, where an amiable major from the KGB would just bring you in for a chat and didn't need to threaten you. That very fact was a threat, and you knew what could happen thereafter. You didn't question the state's capacity to do horrible things to you. You therefore tried to ensure it didn't. But again, I think the thing is, and again, picking up on what Andrei was saying about sort of the how difficult it is to move away from a mobilization society. In a way, the Soviet era was one in which that had had quite a long time to take place. Mm-hmm. And it had institutions that were, as it were, had their own momentum. You didn't need people to be enthusiastic because the institutions had their own integrity. Now, here we have in Putin, these institutions do not really exist. Or rather, they exist so long as Putin is constantly breathing life into the zombie or Frankenstein sort mm-hmm. of state. And in that context, we've seen that the war threat hasn't succeeded in mobilizing people. Crimea, everyone, yep, great, Krim Nash. Mm-hmm. But then Donbass, no one has any great enthusiasm for. Right. Syria, who cares, or whatever. Yeah. I think it's clearly a non-starter. We might see some element of trying to pick some sort of enemies within, some politicians and business people who are corrupt.
This piece in Komsomolska Pravda, they clearly suggested that.
Yeah, but the trouble with that is I don't think anyone is going to think, good Lord, the rest of the elite must be fine. They've identified the bad apples. You know, there is such endemic suspicion and cynicism within society. And it's a question, well, where can Putin go for safe targets? Well,
this is what I'm... I mean, if we may not be going back to the 70s light. We may be going back to the 30s light. But what I'm wondering is, repression has been increasing steadily since 2012, since Putin returned to the Kremlin. It's already there. And you wonder, where do they go from where they are now? What do they do next?
I don't see... Or rather, I mean, it could happen... But I don't see it being something that can happen without actually really quite disproportionate risks in terms of sort of tearing this country apart. See, I mean, I don't think this is a 1930s situation. I think actually we're in a situation where there aren't nice, neat parallels, however much we desperately look for them.
Maybe 70s with a little more teeth then?
A little more teeth, more hair.
Brezhnev had a lot of hair.
Exactly. I think it's more that you might say, in a way, Putin is now... And I don't think we need to shed tears for him, a prisoner of a system that he himself has created. And not just a system in the sense of just, you know, government ministers and everything else, but also a relationship with the Russian people and a vision of the Russian people. He can't now easily, for example, play the nationalist card in the sense of Russian ethnic nationalist. That would be exceedingly dangerous.
Yes.
Within a federation. There's a limit to how far he can ratchet up the whole "the West is after us," and to an extent,
I don't see how he could ratchet up any more.
Well, exactly, and you know, I think that there are sort of very distinct limits of how that's actually going to affect ordinary Russians. Now, I mean, I'm sure there are smart, soulless people in the Kremlin and the presidential administration trying to work out precisely who they can blame next. Lizard people, I don't know, whoever. It's hard to see how a meaningful strategy can be based on that negativity. But also it's hard to see how there can be much expansion of repression, except insofar as it is targeting people who are actively challenging the state.
Mm-hmm. Andrei, last word to you. Where can this go?
Well, I think might be it's instrumental to try to look at how Putin tried to use history, Russian history, because it was always about Russian history. You know, it's such a useful instrument to make your point about anything. And for the last, I don't know, 2-3 years, the Kremlin toyed with the idea of remembering the First World War because it was an anniversary and a centenary of this war. And we got all these claims about the new World War coming, and people were actually, we tried to make this point on state TV. And now we are having the new event coming is the centenary of the revolution. And actually, it's a big point for Putin because it's all about the Tsarist Empire, where we needed to stop in February or before, all these things about the new political regime, all things about revolutionaries. And I think we would try to use this card because it's safe, it's appealing people, and it's already proven to be a really very good point especially for the middle classes. To be frank, I'm got tired of my friends talking about that. Look, it might be better with Putin because otherwise we might get bloody revolution of the 1917 in our streets and people would be killed by people from Aurora and all this talk, and they completely forgot about that. Well, actually, 100 years passed. So right. It's a very emotional thing.
So you think they're going to use, and I've suggested this on the blog in the past, that I argue that they're actually terrified of this anniversary because the first colored revolution wasn't orange or rose, it was red, and it happened in Putin's hometown. You're arguing the same thing, Andrei, that they would be using the anti kind of revolutionary spirit on the anniversary of the Bolshevik Revolution, yeah?
Yeah, absolutely. And also it opens so many good opportunities to engage people in absolutely crazy discussions about whether Putin is to resurrect the Tsarist Empire and to become a Tsar. And the reflection of this is the most recent show made by Mr. Zhirinovsky when he, tried to sing the Tsarist hymn. So I think we already see the start of his campaign, and it might be huge.
Mm. No, that's something to watch for. I expect they'd probably even bury Lenin on that day. Mark.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to say, I mean, if that happens, and it may well, I will so look forward to seeing how that supine lump Zhuganov squares being, on the one hand, a sort of a loyal false oppositionist, and at the same time, actually stomaching all this sort of take on the Bolshevik Revolution that his party is, after all, meant to look back as their wellspring.
Well, it's only a year away, so we have that to look forward to. And on that note, we'll wrap it up. That's all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me in the studio has been co-host Mark Galliotti, a senior research fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, a visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. And joining us on the Skype line from Washington, D.C. has been Andrei Soldatov, co-founder of the investigative website Agentura RU and co-author of the books Red Web, The Struggle Between Russia's Digital Dictators and New Online Revolutionaries, and The New Nobility, the Resurrection of Russia's Security State and the Enduring Legacy of the KGB. Thank you, gentlemen, for an enlightening discussion.
It's been fun.
It's been a lot of fun. I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Kancheva, and my indispensable and totally awesome colleague, Pavel Butorin, managing editor of RFRL's Russian language television program, Current Time, which you can watch at www.currenttime.tv. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes, you could read the Power Vertical blog, and watch the Daily Vertical at rfrl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. The Power Vertical podcast and all Power Vertical products will take a break next week, as I will be attending a conference in Tbilisi, Georgia, which, by the way, is one of my favorite cities. We'll be back on October 7th, and until then, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noize MC.